Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. As you can tell, Dr. Paul is not in the studio. He's traveling today. So I will take the Dr. Paul chair in the studio. But thankfully, I do have a guest with me today. And that guest is an old friend and former colleague in Dr. Paul's office, Jeff Deist, who is now the president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. Jeff, thanks so much for joining me.
Daniel, it's always good to see you and talk to you.
It's always a great conversation. We're going to do a little something different today, Jeff. And you and I had a discussion a couple of days ago about Twitter, social media, and how Twitter storms are themselves becoming news, and how the news cycle feeds off of Twitter, feeds off of the social media, and sort of becomes part of the news. And we sort of, from there, we were thinking about, for example, Marshall McLuhan, the great public intellectual, Canadian public intellectual and philosopher, who coined the term "the medium is the message," and it's been, talked about for a long time, and actually is being revisited in the era of social media. And it's the idea that there's kind of a symbiosis between the actual medium that delivers the message and the message itself, and that the medium of delivery should also be analyzed and looked at separately from the message. And so that brings us to Twitter. It brings us to the Twitter storm. Anyone who may have been in a coma or sleeping or otherwise engaged these past few days, I'll do a quick update. Over the weekend, a Democratic Congresswoman from Minnesota, Ilhan Omar, who happens to be a Muslim Somali American, she retweeted a tweet from Glenn Greenwald, writer for The Intercept, where he criticized GOP leader Kevin McCarthy for his threats to punish actually the two Muslim women in Congress for criticizing Israel. And Greenwald wrote in his tweet criticizing McCarthy, "It's stunning how much time U.S. political leaders spend defending a foreign nation, even if it means attacking free speech rights of Americans." And Omar retweeted that with a little comment, "It's all about the Benjamins." And that, of course, set off a firestorm. And she was accused of being anti-Semitic by bringing in the issue of money when it comes to lobbying in Israel. And someone asked her, the editor, the opinion editor for Forward, which is a Jewish American publication, replied, "Love to know what you mean. Who is paying American politicians to be pro-Israel?" And she replied, "AIPAC." So she dug in a little deeper. And of course, that set off the firestorm more. But we're not here to discuss the content of this or the question of supporting versus not supporting Israel, but rather to discuss the firestorm itself and how one retweet became something that dominates the news cycle for an entire week. So, Jeff, that's a long introduction, but I know you were watching it. What is your take on this whole issue of the medium of Twitter and how it affected the story?
Well, none of this is news. That's the problem. This is narrative. There's a big difference between reporting actual events that happen in Congress and reporting on people's social media, which is, again, not news. So we have this cycle of media talking endlessly about media, and reporters love to insert themselves into stories. Social media are influencers love to insert themselves in stories, become part of the story by responding to a tweet or issuing a provocative tweet, whatever it might be. So this really, I think we ought to be a little worried about all this, because I don't care what media thinks about other media. It's not news. There's nothing real here. This is all fluff. But here's the problem. Caitlin Johnstone has pointed out in several articles how important the narrative is, and how it's controlled in part through new platforms like social media. And so that gets all of us, myself included, sort of bound up in this arms race. We feel like if we're not participating in social media, if we're not responding, reacting, we're not part of the conversation. However small a part of that conversation we might be, as opposed to people who have a million or 10 million Twitter followers, we feel like if we're not part of the conversation, someone else will be and will take it over. So as a result, everyone from a Glenn Greenwald to a member of Congress to a dopey celebrity to Trump and everyone in between to just, young people with 10 followers, everyone feels the need to chime in. And oftentimes that chiming in happens without a lot of thought, without a lot of knowledge, without a lot of wisdom. And Daniel, I'm sure you and I are both guilty of this as well. I don't want to cast aspersions on other people. Yes. Only. And so the problem is we have these meta narratives. We have media focused on media rather than actual news. We have a tempest in a teapot. And what happens is it creates perceptions. It crafts the narrative. So even though it's all BS and it's more smoke than fire, nonetheless, it begins to shape opinions. And here's the thing. It turns out that the internet and especially social media platforms have been a double-edged sword of sorts for libertarian-minded people, because on the one hand, we have platforms and reach and eyeballs available to us at virtually no cost that we never had in the pre-digital age, when the New York Times or Walter Cronkite or something was all that you had. So that's the good side. The flip side is that there's so much white noise. There's such an avalanche of information and news sites and feeds and social media and blogs that getting through all that white noise frequently enough, repetitively enough, to actually move the needle one way or the other a bit is very, very difficult. So we live in a time without fact-checking where everyone has a narrative, everyone has an opinion, everyone has something they want to advance or promote. None of this is news, but it's masquerading as news. So it's very, very dangerous. And I think McLuhan is not rolling over in his grave. He's actually applauding in his grave and saying, I was right.
And fact-checking itself becomes a way to try to control the narrative, which is interesting. But, you know, thinking about this, you know, it's almost, you think about there's a rush to control the narrative, as Caitlin Johnstone pointed out, the narrative is key. There's a rush to establish the narrative, to reinforce the narrative in a situation where it, almost time itself is accelerating. It seems as if Twitter and other social media has accelerated time, has accelerated the creation of, I guess you would say, pseudo-news, and I think that's probably accurate. It's almost kind of a Hegelian dialectic where you have the reaction, a reflection, and a synthesis. The reaction, for example, in the case of the Minnesota Congresswoman, was dominated by condemnation, increasingly heated condemnation, to the point where I think it was President Trump that said she should quit. And then there was a period of reflection, and there were a lot of, for example, a lot of American Jews, liberal American Jews, say, hey, hold on, what's the big deal here? AIPAC doesn't speak for me. What's wrong with? And there were other people of more sort of a broader perspective saying that, well, of course, the lobbying group wants to use money and leverage money and power to affect policy. So there was a period of reflection, and then a synthesis comes after it. But we're seeing this, and I think you pointed out so well, you know, we're also seeing this with something like, for example, the Venezuela story that we've been following. This rush to get ahead of the narrative, to establish the narrative. And I think that is yet another example of what we're talking about with Twitter and social media. And yes, indeed, I am guilty of the same thing. It feels like you're left behind if you don't get in there right away and try to establish it.
The narrative on Venezuela coming from the neoconservatives is that if you don't support the immediate resignation or ouster of Maduro, you're actually a Chavista, and you support tyranny, and you're a terrible person. So that's the underlying narrative behind a lot of the criticism of Venezuela, and even the criticism of the representative you mentioned the other day when she was grilling Elliot Abrams. So we have to understand this stuff for what it is. It's a form of guerrilla warfare. The late Carl Hess, who was a good friend of Murray Rothbard's for quite some time, who was, of course, had been a speechwriter for Barry Goldwater, senior at one point, he wrote a really fascinating book called Community Technology, where he basically posits, along the lines of Marshall McLuhan, that technology will replace ideology in large part. In other words, how we deal with one another technologically will matter far more than our ideological perceptions. So we're starting to see that. Now, there is an ideological component underlying, let's say, the Venezuela narrative on both sides, one clamoring for intervention, one hopefully not. But nonetheless, that's starting to matter less than who gets hold of the technology and crafts the narrative, because most Americans don't know much about Venezuela. Most Venezuelans had never heard of the new National Assembly leader until a week or two ago. Most people are busy with their mortgages and their kids and their life. So they're just going to get little drips and drabs from social media, maybe from the cable news shows. And if those drips and drabs say, well, Maduro's a monster, he's oppressing his people, they're starving, and that's all you get, I think a lot of people ultimately would support some sort of U.S. intervention, whether that's actually boots on the ground or not. But if the narrative is that, well, the United States has a very sordid and poor track record of intervening in Latin America generally, that there's more support out there for Maduro than the headlines are showing, that the National Assembly leader is of course not the president, he never ran for president. If you start to get some facts like that, then the perception might change. But unfortunately, I think for most of us, we crystallize our opinion on day one. In other words, we dig in, we hear something, it either comports or fails to comport with our worldview, and we pick a side, and that's it. We saw that with the young men from the Catholic school in Covington, Kentucky, and what happened during this incident by the Lincoln Memorial. We see it with Representative from Minnesota just the other day. We see it with Venezuela. We see it with all kinds of things, because as Carl has understood, we're emotional and reactive and emotive beings, at least as much, probably more, than we are rational beings. So the libertarian message often requires something more than a soundbite or a talking point. It requires actually connecting a few dots and understanding a few layers of a story or an issue. And that doesn't lend itself well to a social media era. I think we need to understand that. I think we need to acknowledge it.
And certainly the era of Twitter accelerates that idea that we have to get out there first. And suddenly there are thousands of experts on Venezuela, and they're all saying the same thing. As you point out, they would have known where Venezuela was just a few days earlier. So the speed, the acceleration also presents challenges to those of us who want to step back and talk about principles. What are you talking about, non-interventionism? Someone is starving. People are starving. He's killing his own people. Gaddafi's killing his own people. You know, getting control of that narrative. And I think, you know, that is one of the most disturbing aspects of this, because I think that intelligence agencies understand this, and they, not to sound too spooky or conspiratorial, but most certainly millions and millions of dollars are being spent to help establish narratives on places like Venezuela before it starts, before people step back to reflect on it. You know, so it's sort of being manipulated by those who want to control the narrative as well.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic form of manipulation, because if you think about it, when people are busy arguing on Twitter, they're not arguing in the streets, they're not arguing in a public square, they're not doing the equivalent of the soapboxes in Hyde Park in London. They're just at home in their jammies, comfortable, and there's an element of that that lends itself to kind of an ersatz existence, and I think it's very helpful for the state to have us all not only dumbed down, but comfortable, and just able to imagine that we're affecting things from our comfortable homes, when in fact we're being duped by social media narratives, some of which may in fact involve malevolent actors. I don't think there's any question that governments around the world and clandestine organizations around the world are covertly using social media to try to influence things. I think that's probably true in the general sense. So it's very frightening that we're all this plugged in digitally, but we're all so unplugged physically. We're so far removed from our actual physical environment and what's going on. And you know, you mentioned first principles. I mean, here's the thing. Libertarianism has a lot of scholarship behind it. It has some theory behind it. It has some ideology behind it. What I would consider proper or correct economics, which is closely affiliated, although not the same thing as libertarianism, also has some thinking and some theory and some big books behind it. And if we find ourselves in an age where nobody reads books, where nobody cares about theory, where no one's interested in original sources, that becomes an ideology unto itself, just like Twitter almost becomes an ideology of however many characters, 140 characters, and knee-jerk reactions. Well, lack of ideology, lack of thought, lack of wisdom, we could almost call that an ideology unto itself. We could call it ad hocism. We could call it presentism. We could call it expediency. We could call it all kinds of things. And this is what creates a dumbed-down population that becomes a bunch of timorous mice who are easily led. And it's very frightening to feel all around us the sort of anti-intellectualism that's happening.
It reminds me of a response to a tweet that I sent out on Venezuela dealing with some objective reality and disagreeing with a person who was mimicking the government line. And her response to us, or his response was, well, my opinion counts too. So this is, I think, in one sentence encapsulates what you've pointed out. But we don't have to be conspiratorial to talk about government manipulation and influence in social media, because it's right out there in front of us. We know that when Facebook got dinged for what we now know the Senate Intelligence Report really affirms was a phony Russiagate, a phony collusion narrative that had been pushed by those who were unhappy about losing the 2016 election. But the reaction to that was the overt involvement in U.S. government-funded NGOs like the Atlantic Council, the German Marshall Fund, and others, who jumped in to help police the internet, police Facebook, decide what was fake news. And lo and behold, fake news turned out to be any news that didn't follow the government narrative. And I can certainly say from the Ron Paul Institute, where Facebook became, as you said earlier, a very low-cost, very effective way to deliver our product to those who willingly signed up to receive our product, once that kibosh was put on it, once the squeeze was put on the information, then the numbers go down and you cease to exist. So it's almost impossible to fight back against this narrative when the government gets involved.
Yeah, it is hard to fight back. And the government is not only involved in one direction, it's involved in two directions. You know, when we think of crony capitalism, when we think of rent seeking, when we think of regulatory capture, we tend to think of industries like pharmaceutical companies, and that they install some of their people in the FDA, and as a result, they are able to get drugs patented and enjoy the benefits, the economic benefits of that patent for many, many years. We all understand that sort of one-way cronyism or one-way street, whereby an ostensibly private sector company or industry avails itself of the government regulatory state to make money. Okay, that's pretty easy for us to understand conceptually. What's not so easy is when it's a two-way street, when businesses aren't just helping themselves, they're also helping the government craft its own narratives. If you recall the famous off-mic conversation between Zuckerberg from Facebook and Angela Merkel in Germany, one time when he said, "Don't worry, we're going to help you with this stuff," meaning there were too many people on Facebook, apparently in Germany, complaining about the immigrants. So we see with Amazon and Jeff Bezos involved in providing cloud data for NSA and other defense-related organizations, we see people like the head of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, agreeing to work with regulators to remove hate, which of course is just another word for free speech restrictions. We see all of these companies working hand in hand with the government in ways that are very new. In other words, they have become partners with government in this media narrative crafting. And so we ought to look at them askance, and we ought to stop viewing them as simply private sector companies that can do what they want and sink or swim with the market. That's not what's happening when taxpayer funding is involved and when government agencies are involved.
Exactly, Jeff. Well, it looks like, you know, your organization, which does such a terrific job of delivering heavy-hitting stuff, good stuff for free, big books, as you say, which is a great word. And we try to do the same in our own way. We have our work cut out for us. So let's hopefully we have a little bit of understanding of how this narrative affects what we try to do, and people can think about this moving ahead in the future. Jeff, I want to thank you very much for joining us today at the Liberty Report.
All right. Thank you, Daniel.
And I want to thank all of our viewers for tuning in. I hope to see you soon on the Liberty Report.